Great song by singer-songwriter Steve Earle, 1984 Copperhead Road, about a family of moonshiners who become a family of pot farmers, and the parallels are pretty obvious here. Organized crime made millions of dollars when booze was prohibited. Today they make millions of dollars because marijuana is prohibited, still illegal. And we're going to get into that a little bit more with the Ganja Godfather, get his views on prohibition. I can imagine how the mob would react if someone tried to change those marijuana laws, as seems to be happening around the country. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. We'll open up the phone lines to you listeners here a little later in the program. Stay with us. Toby Rogers, I can understand why neither you nor Silvio could name names of customers in here. You name a couple here and there, but I can imagine you getting all kinds of trouble if you were to say who these high-profile celebrities are who are regular customers. But one name that comes up, Bernie Madoff.
Right.
Tell me how that – it's. I would not think of Bernie Madoff as a pot smoker.
Yeah, I would not either. But actually, Silvio was Bernie's dealer for years and years. And the New York Post just ran a Page Six just ran a story on it on Tuesday. Regarding Silvio and Silvio's love triangle with an Israeli model that was working at the Madoff Securities.
So Silvio is dating her, and then Bernie Madoff sort of has designs on her, right?
Right, and. Silvio decided to, keep his keep on a friendly terms with him, but he did say that if Bernie crossed the line, he was going to not whack him, but he was gonna do some serious bodily injury to him.
Madoff would refer to him as a hippie, and he'd say to this woman, "What are you doing with this hippie?" Right.
Right. Well, that was also right around 9/11 as well. Word got around that this woman was having, her name was Leah in the book, was having Silvio's baby, and Madoff called her into the office and said, what do you could have had everything. You could have had a car, a driver, an apartment. You could have had gold. You could have had me, and you threw it all away for this weed dealing hippie.
You have another section of the book where you say you go on a run with Silvio when he's making deliveries, and you say the first customer lived in Scarsdale, or at least he had a house there, someone so famous that even if I just mentioned his profession, it would be easy to figure out who he was. His wife is equally up there in the celebrity universe. We made a left in the driveway, drove up to the front door. Somebody walks out with a black envelope filled with cash, and then I guess the couple's up in the window waving. A couple of names come to mind, but you're not going to tell us any more hints, right?
No, there's been a lot of rumors online about that it was Jay-Z and Beyonce, who do have a house in Scarsdale. But no, I'm not at liberty to really say who it was. But I will say, though, that Jay-Z and Beyonce, that their house on Heathcote Road and Sherbrooke Park Road, is one of the most dangerous intersections in Westchester County. And they should certainly put a light right there. I was actually hit by a car when I was about 9 years old, right outside of their future home. And they should be careful when they're, Blue Ivy's walking around. It is it's one of the most dangerous streets in Scarsdale for sure.
Let's talk about prohibition. I got a pretty good idea based on this book what your views about marijuana are and what they should be. But I mean, for organized crime, and it's a bonanza. I can't imagine that Silvio would ever want to see the laws loosen up or change, right?
No, not at all. In fact, I'm willing to bet that he'll be donating some money to the Chris Christie campaign for 2016, because Christie just promised that he would crack down on all the marijuana states that are legalizing marijuana and that are marijuana self-sufficient states, not just ones that have recreational use, but also medicinal states like Montana are totally marijuana self-sufficient. So there's no infrastructure, no criminal organizations bringing weed into those states. And Chris Christie said he's going to crack down on it, and Silvio's quite supportive of it, although he doesn't want his California connections breaking down.
Yeah, I mean, this is really big money. I know that the changes in Colorado and Washington are already affecting the Mexican cartels. It's a huge hit to them, and I would think as the things ease up in the rest of the country, it's going to really hurt organized crime in various forms.
If marijuana was ever legalized in New York, it would be it would shut Silvio down for sure.
You said he has some kind of new travel package. What does that mean?
Oh yeah, that's great. He He set this up through his a very exclusive offer to the, I guess, the ultra elite of New York, celebrities and people who are from out of town or do business in New York. You can set up a whole package now through Silvio, a travel package. You get a hotel room, any drugs you want, escort girls. You can pick out of a catalog, like ordering food off a menu. Give you VIP passes to clubs and parties around New York. And it's all for a set price, depending on the needs of the customer. And he does it in a very personal, has the personal touch that he has in all his mob operations, I guess. He picks the client right up at the airport in a limousine, brings them right to the hotel, hands them the drugs, introduces them to the girls, and takes them to the clubs if they want. So it's a new operation that he recently set up, and he's quite proud of it. It's slow and it's emerging, but it's happening.
It just seems like with the information that you're making public and that he's making public, a description like that, that some law enforcement person who's listening could figure it out.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he's in foul. Maybe he has law enforcement connections. That part I don't know about. Lucky Luciano certainly did. He was making $12 million a year bootlegging alcohol in 1928. And eight of that $12 million went back into bribing law enforcement and politicians in New York.
And media, too. You make the point that that organized crime's always had their media people.
That's right. In fact, I broke in the story in the Ganja Godfather that the New York Times was on Tommy's payroll and used to publish articles right before he had to testify in court in the 1960s that he had a heart attack and that he couldn't make it and they'd have to reschedule the meeting. And it would always happen. It went around the clock all through the 60s. There's articles in the New York Times website right now that talk about these heart attacks. And it's all BS. It's all disinformation that benefited Tommy Eboli and the Genovese crime family at the time.
Let's talk about the family a little bit. I mean, you mentioned earlier in the program that, the family, these mobsters, these old-time mobsters, didn't want their kids to be mobsters. Maybe John Gotti is the exception. But they wanted them to go to college, do something else. So what was the reaction within the Eboli family when it becomes obvious that Silvio has gone down this path?
They weren't pleased. They were hoping he'd go to college like the rest of us were doing at the time. And he refused. He wanted to be a musician, and he wanted to chart his own life and do his own thing. And it was a long struggle. It wasn't an easy decision. It wasn't. A lot of people think this is a quick money and easy money. It's a long haul. And he really worked hard at it. And it's not something that that you can just get in on and do easy. It's a long-term arch getting in the criminal underworld. And he's a real master at it.
At least one member of his family is aware of it and profited from it. This is Frank.
Right.
Is that the real name?
No, it's not. I try not to deviate too much from the narrative, but no, that's not his real name. But he is a real person, and he was the boss of the Eboli family up until 2013, up until Silvio basically took him out and became boss himself during the Feast of San Gennaro in Little Italy.
We'll come back to that, but let's talk about what kind of business was going on with Uncle Frank and Silvio, because Frank was, I guess, was his biggest customer.
Right.
Describe it.
Yeah, well, Uncle Frank ran the Upper West Side for years, decades, delivering marijuana. And he, at the end of it all, he ended up buying exclusively wholesale from Silvio. And there was a constant tension between the two of them in terms of pricing and who deserved what and seniority. And so it snowballed all the way up to the fall of 2013. And it ended up, it ended up as a BCO job in the end.
Well, I'm gonna have you describe that. But you, in the book, you create these scenes of showdown sort of arguments where Uncle Frank is lecturing Silvio. To Frank, he thinks Silvio works for him.
Right.
So even though he's getting a great deal on the price on this marijuana, it's not good enough.
No, it's not, because Frank believed that Silvio was making a profit off of him, which he was. But I guess with the seniority and the whole hierarchy of the mob, Uncle Frank believed it should be otherwise. But then in the end, why would he be doing it? So it was a constant tension between the two of them, was the deals. A lot of that was psychological control over on Uncle Frank, over his nephew, trying to you know, basically say, I'm in charge, and constantly belittling him and not making him feel too comfortable during these transactions.
And so as it develops, Uncle Frank sets him up, I mean, or at least that's what it sounds like in the book.
Right.
Tell the story.
I met Uncle Frank during the Fish days in the mid-1980s. He was right there. And I had couple run-ins with him, you know, on the personal level. So when I heard about him running the Upper West Side, it was, you know, it was just, he knew me. So he also knew what I was doing. So I think ultimately what happened was is he floated that around to other people in Silvio's orbit. And some people were not pleased about that. So when that went down, Silvio ended up getting robbed. That was actually Uncle Frank's cover. It was Uncle Frank who was actually committing these robberies in revenge for what he thought was being overpriced for the original buys.
So when Silvio finds out, San Gennaro, how did it go down?
What happened was is they, long story short, it was September 10th, 2013. They figured out through email and through some connections in Colombia that it was Uncle Frank orchestrating these robberies, as well as some other internal family matters that were pretty dramatic, to say the least. And that was when the decision was made to take Uncle Frank out. Uncle Frank used to go to a restaurant in Irvington, and he would walk around a park before he'd get the train back to Tudor City where he lived. And they met him in the park, a goon squad, put him on a boat. A friend of Silvio had a yacht club right next door, put him on a boat, took him out to the out past the Statue of Liberty, ended up putting him on a fishing boat from the Fulton Fish Market crew, and they took him way out into the Atlantic, put him in a barrel, and poured some cement in it, tormented him a lot, and tossed him out in the ocean. And that was the end of that.
I couldn't tell from the book. It sounded, and at least in some passages, like you were there. Were you there?
Well, I was, yeah.
Well, I mean...
I didn't know it was going to actually happen, because a lot of these things never actually occur. You think something's going to happen or some big load of violence is about to unload, and it doesn't happen. So I wasn't sure if it was going to disarm or not at the time when it was taking place. You never really know, and it ended up actually happening. So it was a pretty frightening event for me.
I would be concerned, Toby, that you're a material witness to a murder, and somebody come knocking at the door.
That may be true. I guess the defense would be it was an international waters. So I don't know, but I have to say what Silvio did was pretty egregious and a horrifying thing. But at the same time, Uncle Frank was no saint, and was really a monster as well. And so it's kind of like, you know, two evils clashing and knocking each other down. It was something I guess that Silvio believed needed to be done.
So is Silvio, would he count as mafia? It certainly is organized crime, but is he under the umbrella of any mafia family? I mean, I know he stems from that, but he's his own organization. He's not part of that older organization, right?
They split. When Vincent the Chin, or the Odd Father, as he later became known, assassinated Tommy Ebley in 1972, the Ebley family broke off from the Genovese crime family orbit, but they still have their long outstanding own hustles that stem all the way down to the East Coast in the bagel business in Florida, and family members all over the place. And yes, it's like all the mafia in New York. It's definitely downsized since the glory days, but it's still mobbed up, as the New York Post said.
Yeah, you start traveling around with Silvio, and the word gets out that he's got a journalist with him working on this thing, and it creates some tense moments as he goes about his business, right?
Right. Yes, there was an incident in upstate New York, Poughkeepsie, to be specific, where he was confronted about me. I was shocked. He actually, I didn't even think I'd be going into the bar for this business meeting. He had brought two guys with him that were his muscle for the night, and he didn't bring them in. He brought me in. And this guy, Fat Johnny, as I name him in the book, was tipped off, I guess, in the end by Uncle Frank, that Silvio had a journalist tailing him. And he was confronted about it. Silvio was honest about the whole thing, but the guy was not too pleased.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, you know, most people in that business would not welcome you with open arms.
Right. It takes, I guess, a special type of criminal to allow the media unprecedented access or an all-access pass to their personal lives and their business life.
So you had to go on the run. Let's talk about that section of we got about 3 minutes or so before our break. So tell me about why you had to go on the run, that attack on Silvio, and how long you were gone and what it was like.
What happened was, actually was the night of the World Series when the Yankees won the World Series in 2009. We were out all night. Silvio sent me around the corner for coffee, and when I came back, he was covered in blood. And we ended up taking him to White Plains Hospital. I was taken to an empty apartment of a friend of his in Columbus Circle. I guess it was kind of a hideaway place if Silvio ever needed it. He ended up putting me there. And from there, me and my girlfriend and myself, we ended up finding a cabin right there in Swan Lake, coincidentally enough. And we stayed there for a little, that winter of 2009, 2010, in a cabin off the grid in Swan Lake in the Catskills, New York. We bounced around all over upstate New York. We went up to, all the way up north to the Adirondacks and Blue Mountain Lake. We ended up in Lake George, Lake Luzerne, Skinny Atlas Lake. We basically lived in almost every part of New York for about 4 years. We were doing it for 4 years. It wasn't until the spring of 2013 that Silvio told me that it was safe to come back to New York at that point.
And you know, was somebody actually looking for you?
I don't know. I think the suspicion was that there might have been. That maybe Fat Johnny might have been looking around, or possibly, I guess in the end, it was Uncle Frank. But Uncle Frank wasn't after me, so it kind of became a comedy of errors. But it was part of the experience as well. Is you're not really sure what you're dealing with when you're dealing with the mafia. You're dealing with disinformation. But you know, we were on the lam for 4 years.
The woman you were with, your girlfriend, mm-hmm. Died.
Yes.
Is that suspicious?
At the time, we thought it was, particularly that day. But afterwards, I guess when all the dust settled, we realized that it was just an anomaly of a coincidence that she fell asleep at the wheel and crashed the car in the other lane. So it was it really had nothing to do with the with Uncle Frank or any of the things that were going swirling around at the time.
I would think that, you know, for a long period there, you were looking over your shoulder, not only worried about some of Silvio's enemies, but about Silvio himself, as you said, might change his mind about letting all this stuff out.
Absolutely. Every day I was with him, I thought maybe it was my last. It was fun in some regards, so there was a lot of times where we had a good time, but it was also terrifying, never really knowing what was going to happen from one day to the next. Didn't know if I was going to get killed or someone was going to kill us. The robbery in 2009 was pretty shocking. So when I came back in 2013, it was always hovering around. And again, of course, he got robbed again, maybe a few months after I got back to New York. And so it started all over again.
I wonder if you're safe now. I mean, is there safety because the book, The Ganja Godfather, is out and you've told what you know? Or is there still stuff that you know that would be a threat to somebody?
You know, I think I'm okay. You know, it's been out for about 6 weeks now. There was a magazine article a couple of years ago. So far, everything has been fine with this book. And I don't feel like my life's in danger, I hope.
All right. We're talking with Toby Rogers, author of The Ganja Godfather. When we come back, we'll open up the phone line, see what might be on your mind here. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. That's one of the last and best harmonies of Lennon and McCartney, the Beatles, two of us, from 1969 recording session that was released later in the Let It Be album. We're talking with Toby Rogers about his book, The Ganja Godfather. In a moment, we'll take some calls from you and then cover some other material here, including a story of a cult that Toby encountered during the time he was on the run. Much more to come here in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Toby, before we open the phone lines, there was one other story I wanted to hear about your time sort of moving around. It was about this wacky cult that you encountered in Montana. How did that come about? And man, the story you paint, the picture you paint in the book is pretty colorful.
Well, I what in the spring of 2013, I came back to New York, and within maybe about 8, 9 weeks, started all over again with Silvio. And he was robbed, and as well as another girl. And I decided, it's time to get out of here. I was started freelancing for this new magazine called Cannabis Now Magazine, which is an American weed publication that's competes with High Times. It started showing up at Barnes and Noble, and other magazine stands. And I'm an old High Times alum, or freelance with High Times for years, and they were very interested in working with me. I gave them an article about Silvio that ended up becoming this book that they published that spring, and they invited me out to stay in Paradise Valley, Montana, and work at what I was told was a resort. The magazine has a office in Berkeley, but they also have a Bozeman office, which is connected to a medical marijuana dispensary called Lionheart. And all of this, the magazine, the dispensary, all of it's a front for a really vile cult, a white supremacist cult called the Church of the Universal Triumphant, and their acronym is CUT. And they make Scientology look like Boy Scouts. They're really one of the most horrible cults in the United States, for sure. Not even they're so demented, they don't even really get out. They haven't been able to branch out that far. Basically stayed in the valley of Paradise Valley, Montana.
So you hear it's a Paradise Valley, Montana. That sounds great. You hear you can stay in this resort. You get there, and it's not much of a resort. I have the rat feces in my mind, but where you're expected to stay.
Was covered with desert mice feces and urine. It's actually a poisonous combination. The family, the Fanuzzi, Chris Fanuzzi, the owner of the magazine and the dispensary, had to hire a crew, and they had to bleach it all first. And we were kind of stuck in the middle of that, along with the cult members, who none of it was kind of a miscommunication all throughout the whole process. But my fiance at the time was black, and our daughter was mixed, and they kind of found out right after we got there, and things went kind of downhill from there.
So this cult, they're white supremacists, but they survive, they exist based on the magazine or the weed business
They got
or
well.
both?
It started in 1958 with some guy named, I guess, John L. Prophet, and it basically they what they call interface different religions: Buddhism, Christianity, New Age, hippieism, whatever is I guess flavor of the month. They used to be Armageddon with the with nuclear war in the 80s, but then of course they went with the Apocalypse 2012 whole movement. They kind of recon their whole religious message, that they were way ahead of the curve with the 2012, when it was actually just nuclear bunkers they were building in Montana. But they were they got Tea Party mumbo jumbo in there too, as well as anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So it runs the gamut.
Man, that was a good place to leave. That's
Yeah.
crazy. We're going to go east of the Rockies. Ryan in Florida. Hi, Ryan. Good morning. You're on with Toby.
Hey, Chubby, how you doing, man?
Oh, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Cool. Thank you. I was just curious about you were talking about, you've obviously smoked out with some several people and friends of yours. Throwing the names on the air, I was just curious about, do they know, or are they aware of you possibly saying, hey, the name on the air? And obviously, we know that it's the acceptance of weed is a lot more tolerant now than it was years ago. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that don't really, the law enforcement agencies and such.
Sure.
So just curious about that. And
Well,
also,
well, there was.
I'm digging the show and enjoying your talk, your conversation here. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Well, there was. There's of course there was quite a number of celebrities that I was introduced to through Silvio that were customers of his and good friends of his. We actually I traveled all over the tri-state area with him one day, dropping off a new I guess strain that he had just gotten, was handing it out to all his celebrity clients, and it was I of course it would be great. Some of these individuals do know that it's happening. Some of them were told that I was a journalist, and they seemed to be comfortable with it because they trusted Silvio so much. I was allowed to tail them as well and go out to rooftop barbecues or parties, VIP parties that were happening at any given night. So it was. I believe that the celebrities would probably be upset and shocked if I went ahead and you know, released the whole list of names.
Yeah, you haven't, right? Yeah.
It was, yeah, I mean, I also got received a list of people who I didn't meet. And, of course, I gave them a wall of protection as well. So, you know, there was, I was thinking, we were talking, Sylvia and I actually were talking about maybe we could do something with the list. But in the end, we decided, no, we wouldn't.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. First-time caller, Brian in San Diego. Hi, Brian. You're on with Toby Rogers.
Hi, Toby. How you doing? Awesome story. What do you do now? I mean, how long have you been with Silvio?
Well, not really with Silvio, but I've known him as a friend for over 30 years. Went to high school together, and but really started working, I guess our professions overlapped in the fall of 2009. So it's going on 6 years, and the book will be released. There's, Silvio's hustling to get somebody to buy the rights for a movie deal, and so it may extend even longer after that.
What do you do now that you're done with?
I'm working on some other projects. I have a true crime story I'm working on, the whole mystery behind the disappearance of Matthew Margolis. I don't know if you're aware of that story, George, in Greenwich, Connecticut, 1984.
No.
But I do know the individual who committed that crime. It's still an unsolved murder, and I'm going to be working on that as my next project.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Wildcard Line John in Long Beach, California. Good morning. You're on with Toby Rogers. How you doing?
Hello again. First of all, Toby, I don't know if anybody's sorry to hear about your fiance, your girlfriend. It must have been a hard time for you at the time with all the stress. So I just wanted to give my condolences.
Oh, thank you. I
think the evidence that that Silvio took you on is, you know, it showed you around as a journalist. It kind of indicates that he wasn't a true member of, you know, directly involved with the mob, because even back in the day, you never would have been gotten that far. You know, Lucky Luciano was killed, they think, because they found out he was doing that last testament of Lucky Luciano, and he got taken out, and they didn't do the, you know, that got him taken out. Mm. So it seems like, isn't this kind of indicative of maybe the mafia is not what it used to be? You know, the mob in secretiveness and all that. Guys are more apt to, because of RICO, are more apt to, you know, rat somebody out for their own skin more than they used to. But also, doesn't it point out that, you know, the mob isn't as tight-knit and don't stick to the rules like they used to? The fact that you were even allowed to be involved and then survive at the same time, if you know what I'm saying.
It's, oh, yeah. Well, I think the whole rust bucket of the what's left of the five families, if you want to call it, it's kind of degraded to the point where it's a lot of union kickbacks and things like that. It's not as a powerful institution as it used to be. And so Silvio and other people like him are able to operate on the streets of New York independently. You know, they've kind of gone almost out of fashion as the Baroni suit. You know, none of today's mobsters wear what John Gotti used to wear. None of them do operate in those lines anymore. That whole infrastructure is gone, pretty much. It's there, but it's like a ghost of what it used to be.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. What's competition like? And I would think that, you know, you mentioned about Silvio going to Jamaica in the early days and bringing back product, and it seems like what I've read, the Jamaicans are pretty ferocious competitors in that New York market. Is there a street-to-street kind of competition and danger involved from rivals?
I don't have a map of the turf of the city, and I don't think anyone can actually lay claim on individual streets anymore. But there definitely is a competitiveness to the delivery business. And a lot of dealers will turn in other dealers and then try to take over their market. It happens all the time, and it's really the insulation of how Silvio operates, that he's hasn't been, you know, other than his own internal family robbing him, he's been pretty safe.
And is it still bicycle messengers are involved in the delivery system?
They moved up to Vespas now. It's Vespas, at least with Silvio.
They've mechanized.
Yes. Well, Silvio, you know, most of Silvio's orders, his personal ones that he does They're usually large orders, so he'll just hop in a cab at that point. But the pedestrian customers, or if you will, his cousins handle those on Vespas all through downtown on the Upper West Side.
We're going to Phil in New Orleans. Hi, Phil. You're on with Toby Rogers.
Good morning, guys. Good morning, Toby, George.
Hey,
howdy.
Phil.
How y'all doing?
Good.
All right.
I was wondering, when marijuana is legalized, how is that going to affect the cartels and the mob in regards to other drugs?
It really fractures them. It's really the beginning of the end. I mean, there's still dealers now in Denver and Seattle, but the economic incentive is really undercut at that point. And so going legit, like in Montana, particularly when it's medicinal, which is kind of a gray area because it's really just a facility to get a medical card. And so it's by de facto, it's recreational in Montana as well. But you can go to a store and walk to a shop, pick up your marijuana, take it home, you can get an ounce a day, which is more than anyone would need. And it's all legal. And therefore, the cartels and the mafia are all cut out. And these companies, they employ tons of workers. They pay taxes. And it's one of the biggest markets out west is this emerging legal marijuana. It's now surpassing cell phones in economic growth.
Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it. At some point it becomes legal. It seems to be the direction of things. Does that mean you diversify into other drugs? I think in the book, I remember you mentioning that Silvio had some kind of a methamphetamine connection, which that changes everything, doesn't it? It's a much less benign sort of a substance than marijuana.
Right. There was an attempt to do the meth. A large meth operation, which actually collapsed after the fall of 2013, it wasn't really stable, and it was. I don't think Sylvia was comfortable with it, to be honest. Even though he was interested in the money for sure, but it was just not his scene, and it eventually ended up crumbling.
It's like in the Godfather movie, Vito Corleone opposing drugs because eventually, it's not a harmless. Recreation like gambling or whatever other things that the mob did, and eventually he lost out, of course, but I can imagine that there would be a lot more heat on something like methamphetamine than from selling marijuana.
Absolutely. And a lot of these mobsters are highly superstitious, and I think there's something about the ganja, that to them they're more comfortable with, at least Silvio for sure.
All right, east of the Rockies, Sean in South Carolina. Hi, Sean. Good morning. You're on with Toby Rogers.
Good morning. Excellent show. Yeah, I was just curious if Toby was aware of Rockefeller as soon as he bought off the AMA in 1913, cocaine, heroin, and shortly after cannabis became illegal. The biggest cult or cartel is the pharmaceutical industry. The CDC admits that pharmaceuticals kill 400,000 people a year in America. You now have one out of seven children on amphetamine, which is basically speed. And I just wanted to hear what he thought about that.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Sean.
Basically, the legal version of what Silvio does, I guess, by and large. But, yeah, the drug companies are predatory business people, just as vicious and predatory as Silvio can be. And the drug companies have really lurched into our lives slowly over the decades, and they're almost becoming ominous everywhere we go. And it's scary. And I think a lot of ways, marijuana goes against that grain. In terms of what its medicinal properties are and how it is actually able to do a lot with it medicinally, and a lot of these drug companies would probably do damage economically if people really tapped into it.
West of the Rockies, Tanner in Colorado. Speaking of places where it's legalized, Tanner, how you doing? You're on with Toby Rogers.
Hey, how you guys?
Good.
I had a question about. So you had, obviously experience with marijuana and the mob. If you had any experience with other drugs in the mob, and if you saw a big difference in amount of violence between, like, say, a heroin dealer and marijuana dealers?
I've actually, you know, personally, this might be embarrassing to some. I've actually haven't done a lot of drugs other than marijuana, maybe mushrooms once in college. But I really, I never did cocaine. I've never done heroin. I've never done hard drugs, prescription drugs. No interest to me at all. Silvio has a personal taste. He likes to do different things here and there, maybe a little coke once in a blue moon. But he's not really heavily involved in the narcotic trafficking, other than marijuana. There was an attempt, as like we were just talking about meth, but he wasn't comfortable with it. The clientele's different; they're not as economically stable as the marijuana customers are, and he eventually pulled out.
There's a story you tell in the book about an encounter he has with this dumpling guy.
Oh yeah,
I thought it was very colorful and story. It seemed out of character for him as far as he went. So tell that story and why it came about.
Well, that's another one of Silvio's, business ventures. Is he does for the ultra rich and also the struggling immigrants that need construction done maybe on a restaurant or something, and they can't afford the union, they can't afford all the permits. They'll go under the table. Silvio is one person you can contact for that. And there was a run-in with this guy Dumpling and Silvio. He was trying to expand his dumpling house on the Lower East Side, and he bought a bar next door to his little house. Money exchanged hands. Work was done, but Dumpling wasn't able to keep up with the money, and things kind of spun out of control. He might have been really injured if it wasn't for me being there. What ended up happening is they kind of let Dumpling go, and they ended up trashing the bar to pieces.
Yeah, you have it in pretty distinct detail. He ordered a bunch of food for his guys, some to eat and some to throw around. He ordered them to plaster the place with dumplings, right?
Well, the pizza was... crazy story. The pizza was to eat, and the dumplings, the 20 or so dozen dumplings that the dumpling guy brought, ended up being painted all over the bar. That's correct.
Is there anybody in the Eboli family he's got to worry about hearing this show or reading the book?
I don't think so, because Silvio is basically in charge of the family now. What the other operation, that what you want to call it, not mafia, whatever it is, whatever this entity is, he's in charge of it, and what he says goes. Family is aware of it. I've interviewed several members of the family for the book that Silvio introduced me to, and we're quite cooperative. We ended up publishing pictures of the Patsy Eboli that were unpublished that are in the book. And so they've been actually supportive overall.
The book's getting a lot of attention. It's certainly an interesting read. Toby, thank you, and let us know what else you're up to. Maybe you can come back sometime.
Absolutely.
All right, the book is called The Ganja Godfather, The Untold Story of New York City's Weed Kingpin. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Bill Friedman, and his mob book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And thanks to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Tricia Pepe, Nathan Staten, our webmaster Tim Banal, producer Chris Boros, and Dan Galante. Good night, everyone.